The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 24, 2003. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. One bright pearl, the gem of Dogen's writing. Dogen Zenji, of course, a 13th century Japanese Zen master, very important in our lineage here, the Soto lineage. He was the one who brought Soto Zen to Japan. A great teacher and a writer. His writings are absolutely beautiful, and in the third part of this, we'll get a sample of that on our third day, where he just breaks into sheer poetry. In fact, this particular piece, I should say, it is in three parts. That's why it lends itself very well now to a three-day sesshin that we'll be doing. In the first part of this piece, he tells the story of Gensha, Zen master, a great Zen master. Well, even that first part is divided, you might say, into two sections. The first section would be a telling of Gensha meeting his teacher and a few exchanges that they had. That's the first part of part one. And then in the second part of part one, which we'll cover today, Gensha then teaches one of his students, a monk, comes up, there's an exchange between Gensha and one of his monks. That'll be part one. And then tomorrow, we might even have to get into part two today. We'll see how the time is flowing here. But part two is going to be the bulk of it, I think, where Dogen expounds on this teaching of Gensha that he offers to the monk. And then finally in part three, which we'll get to on the third day, Dogen breaks into absolute beautiful poetry, basically on the title, One Bright Pearl. And it's a marvelous example of Dogen's writing. It's also what's very profound, very deep teaching here, and yet at the same time, because of the beautiful poetry that's in it, because of the story, I think it's also, to some degree, fairly accessible, though certainly there is depth to it that I'll try to bring out. One Bright Pearl is the fourth fascicle in Dogen's masterwork, the Shobo Genzo, of which the Genjo koan is the third fascicle. So these two pieces, the Genjo koan and One Bright Pearl, are right there at the front of the Shobo Genzo, which goes on for 95 fascicles. So Dogen put these pieces near the front, partly because of their importance, I think, and also because certainly the Genjo koan basically lays out all of Dogen right there at the beginning. Dogen also presented the Genjo koan to a lay student, again making it to some degree fairly accessible, though of course also very profound teaching. And I think the same can be said here of One Bright Pearl. So it's truly a gem of Dogen's writing, and well worth revisiting for those of you who might be coming back to it now again. The title, One Bright Pearl, as I mentioned it in the third part, Dogen just breaks into just waxing poetically about this title, One Bright Pearl. But in Japanese, just say a little bit about this, the title Ika Myoju is the title in Japanese, and the term Ika means one, Myo means clear or bright, and Ju means either a jewel or pearl. Sometimes you see this translated as one bright jewel. But I think if we go back and look at these terms a little bit, the term Ika, even though I said it means one, in Japanese and Chinese, these are strange languages in some ways, if we're only familiar with Western languages. For example, that in Chinese and Japanese both, they have what are called counters. I don't know if you're familiar with counters. But in English, of course, or German or French or Spanish, I assume in those languages, I think we just count one, two, three, however you say that, in whatever language. But in Chinese and Japanese, they don't just, well, they might have a one, two, three, but then it depends on what you're counting. Because if you're counting flat objects, like I remember when I was in Japan, I went up to the postmaster there to get some stamps, and I was going to order 10 stamps. And, I went up there, I forget what I said, something or other, kite. Well, it was the wrong counter. It was the wrong number 10. Because I was using a counter for something else, probably the general counter that they have that children use and things like that. It would be similar to our counter, since we only have one general counter. I mean, in other words, we count everything, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whether you're counting people or stamps or birds or you name it. We say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but in Japanese, they use different counters. So when I ordered this the stamps, I used the wrong counter, and I remember the clerk was just, really frowning at me. Finally, she threw the stamps down. There were 10, but she threw the stamps down, and she said, "Jukite," and means, that's the word for 10 and for flat objects, you see, but I was using something else. So you have to be very careful. Well, there's like 40 different counters in Japanese and Chinese. I mean, they have a counter for birds, they have a counter for small animals, they have a counter for large animals, they have a counter for people, they have a counter for flat objects like stamps, and they also have a counter for round objects. So the reason I'm going on about this is because it's important to understand that in this title, Ika Myoju, Ika is a counter that's used for round objects. So if already in the Japanese mind, if you say Ika Myoju, like we just say one bright pearl, but the one doesn't lend any significance to what it is that we're talking about. Whereas in Japanese, that would already suggest roundness, just in saying one, using the kind of one that they're using here. So, and in that way, I think to interpret this as a jewel, which might be kind of round, but not necessarily round, but also having many facets, that might not be really quite what Dogen was going with here. I think for that reason, pearl probably fits it a little better. So one bright pearl. Another thing, too, about the term pearl, this came up actually at that workshop. Somebody brought this up, and it's a very interesting idea, though I'm not quite sure that it was in the mind of Dogen, but it certainly could have been, and it certainly lends itself to what Dogen is writing about here. The understanding, the sense that a pearl is layered, has multiple layers in it. Very interesting thought there. How a pearl is formed, an oyster, right? Some irritation is there in the oyster, and it begins to lay down this material over this irritation, this little piece of grit or sand or whatever that's gotten in there. And it keeps putting layer upon layer upon layer on this little, building up the pearl in layers. And so in this image then of a pearl, we would have this sense of multiple layers of perhaps like multiple layers of reality. We can have many different kinds of faces or surfaces to reality or whatever. This is one aspect that does kind of lend itself to this, but at the same time we also have one. So it's like we have many and we have one. But of course that same kind of image I think does also come through in the image of a jewel, in the sense of a multifaceted jewel that would have many, many faces to it, and yet at the same time it's just one object here. But both of these kinds of images then lend themselves, I think, to this image that Dogen is bringing out. Actually, of course, it's Gensha's image, as we'll see once we get into this piece a bit. But again, I'm going with pearl because I think that counter at the beginning really gives it away. Well, let's take a look at this, and I think today we'll get into it. We'll certainly cover the first part of this piece. We have the story of Gensha, first as he meets his teacher, Seppo, and then later his exchange with one of his students, one of Gensha's students. So let me read here. One by Bright Pearl by Dogen Zenji. The great master Gensha had the religious name Shibi. His lay surname was Sha. In lay life, he enjoyed fishing and used to ply his boat on the Nandai River, following the ways of the fishermen. No doubt he did not expect the golden fish that comes of itself without fishing for it. Yeah, so here's Gensha, an ordinary guy, following the ways of the fishermen, living an ordinary life, plying his boat on the Nandai River, and Dogen takes the opportunity now to pick up on this image. He didn't expect the golden fish that comes into the net of its own without fishing for it. Well, I've talked about the golden fish. You've heard me talk about the golden fish. That this golden fish is his image of, well, what it is that we truly want, what it is that our heart really sings for, what it is that we actually need, but that we actually do have. But it's a matter of waking up to it, realizing it, finding it, seeing it. But it comes of its own. Since we are confused and we don't know what it is that we need or truly do want, we go looking for it. We try to find it in a career or a relationship or an automobile or whatever it is. We go after one thing or another, somehow trying to satisfy ourselves, trying to appease the deep ache in the heart, to quiet the ache in the heart. This is the golden fish we're seeking, but we don't really know that. We don't really understand it. We're always looking for some particular object, but the golden fish isn't really an object. It isn't really something that we can find, something we can go after or hold in our hand, and yet this is what we're always drawn to. It's what we're always thinking about, what we always conjure up in our mind, something that we could grasp, or something that maybe we think if we had it, even if it's enlightenment, we form enlightenment into an idea, and then we go after it like it's something that maybe we can take hold of and possess. But nothing like this will ever satisfy. And yet there is this golden fish that swims into the net of its own without fishing for it. We don't have to go after it. And we don't, since we don't really know what it is, we shouldn't even begin to form ideas about it, or form ideas of, say, enlightenment, or even imagining what it would be finally that would quiet your heart and that would meet your needs and your wants, where all this would be satisfied. Because nothing, there isn't anything that would ever do that for us, and yet there is this golden fish. And Gensha wasn't really expecting this, Dogen says. Of course, sometimes maybe we can expect that we will wake up to ultimate reality. But still, if we form any idea of it, the golden fish doesn't swim in. So it's best that we just set all this aside. Who knows why Gensha suddenly had this experience, but here Dogen goes on. He said that at the beginning of the Katsu era of the Tang Dynasty, that would be from 860 to 873, he suddenly wished to leave the world. He left his boat and went into the mountains. So suddenly, here's Gensha, he's just living the life of a fisherman. Suddenly he has this experience where he wants to leave the world and go into the mountains. When it says he wants to leave the world, he's finding something dissatisfying here in our ordinary ways of getting and spending and chasing about, trying to appease the ache in the heart with one thing or another. Something comes up, he doesn't quite understand what this is, but he has this desire, it's just awakened in him, he wants to leave the world. And he left his boat and he went into the mountains. He left this way of this occupation that he knew, and went off into the mountains, into a place he was unfamiliar with. He was then 30 years old, Dogen says. Having awakened to the uncertainty of the transient world, he realized the Buddha Way's eminence and nobility. He finally climbed Snowy Peak Mountain, called on the great Zen master Seppo, and worked on the way day and night. So here at the age of 30, what he awoke to then was this uncertainty of this world, this transient world. It's transient, it's changing, it's nothing is holding, there's nothing you can hold to here. You know, this thing that we might think we to go after, the career, the thing, the relationship, the whatever, but it's all transient, changing. And nothing holds still. Nothing can be really ultimately depended on that won't change and turn into something else. If it's something that brings us some kind of a momentary pleasure, it is just that, it is momentary, and then when it is gone, we have a longing in our heart, an emptiness in our heart. And it's very, very painful, very uncertain. And of course, behind it all, this whole thing is marked with death. You know, that we ourselves are very transient, temporary, moving through. It doesn't take long. The older we get, the more we notice just how quickly it all seems to be passing by. Well, here at the age of 30, he suddenly got a pretty good taste of this, and awakening to this uncertainty. He realized that the Buddha's way was, he realized its eminence and nobility, he said here. He realized that there's something different about this way, that it isn't to go after the thing or to conjure up something in our mind, some kind of heavenly abode or some place or someone or some story or reading or whatever that we can rely on. It is something completely different than this, that it transcends this whole world of transience. And so realizing this, having somehow, for whatever reason, very clear understanding that there was something to this way, this Buddha's way, that was different from our usual approach to things. He climbed this snowy peak mountain, it said, and he called on the great Zen master, Seppo, and worked on the way day and night. Now, Seppo certainly was a great Zen master. Gensha, too, becomes a great Zen master. And here we have these two great, ultimately, they will both become two great teachers meeting. And we have this incredible encounter between these two remarkable people. But Gensha, first arriving, he spent some time there, and then as the custom was too, and in that time and in that place, there were a lot of good teachers around. Maybe not a lot of good teachers, never probably really a lot of good teachers around, but there were teachers around. And Gensha decided to leave and to go and check out some other teachers, which is not necessarily a bad idea. I think it's good to be exposed to different teachers and different kinds of teaching. But look at what happens here. So one day, to visit masters widely in other areas and perfect his practice, he took up his traveling pouch and was leaving the mountain when he struck his toe on a rock. As it bled in intense pain, he had an abrupt self-realization and said, "This body is non-existent. Where does pain come from?" He immediately returned to Seppo. Yeah, interesting point here. So he's going off to see these teachers, just barely on his way. He strikes his foot on a rock, starts to bleed in intense pain. And then suddenly he had this abrupt self-realization. Well, this abrupt self-realization, what do you suppose that would be? Sometimes we think if we hear self-realization, maybe we think that somehow we finally figure ourselves out, we finally know what we're about or something like that. That's not self-realization. To realize the self is to realize the self as emptiness, that there's no particular thing here that is me or I. This is self-realization. And then he said, "This body is non-existent. Where does the pain come from?" So this is a self-realization. Suddenly he realized that the self, this thing that he had been holding to, trying to please and protect all along, suddenly he realizes this is empty. What he said was that it's non-existent. Yeah, that's probably a bit much if he said it's non-existent. But he said, but where does the pain come from? Well, in saying that it is non-existent, what he realizes is that this body, this thing that for most of us seems so solid and real and enduring, he realized that it is part of this very transience that had overwhelmed him, made him go to see Seppo in the in the first place, that it is just is changing, this flux. And as a result of that, there isn't any real thing that's the body. Because from moment to moment, it is continuously changing. Yeah, so he said it is non-existent here. But this is what we can awaken to. If you realize that there's no particular thing here that is the body, but still there's this pain. He has this pain. So if the body's not real, if there isn't any particular thing that's the body, where does this pain come from? Very good question. What he saw in that moment was the emptiness of this all. And yet at the same time, there's a body here. There's a bleeding toe here. There's pain here. So suddenly he saw these two at once. Or at least he saw first the emptiness of it, the unreality of it, the insubstantiality of it, the thoroughgoing relativity of it, that there's no particular body, no enduring thing here whatsoever. And yet there is this pain here. It isn't like because there's no body that there's nothing at all. There's still this pain. There's still this reality here, in spite of the fact that there's nothing here in particular at all. Well, he saw these two points. The body is non-existent, but where does the pain come from? Very good question at that point. But already, it seems, at least if not at this point, if he doesn't understand at this point, he already understands by the time he calls on Seppo once again. He goes back to see Seppo. Says he immediately returned to Seppo. And Seppo asked him, he said, "What is this ascetic Shibi?" Remember, his lay name was Shibi. He said, Seppo asked him, "What is this ascetic Shibi?" And Gensha answered, "I will never deceive others." What is this ascetic Shibi? Well, what's he going to say? What are you going to say? I'm Gensha? I'm me? What are you going to say? What is this person here called Shibi? What are you? Seppo could see that something had happened here with Gensha. He comes back and he just simply asks him this. And of course, there could just be this ordinary answer, you know, that we might answer in the ordinary way. But Gensha had already had a profound understanding here, a profound change had already occurred in his mind. And he answered, he said, "I will never deceive others." And this greatly pleased Seppo, who then said, "There is no one who does not harbor those words, yet no one could utter them." He continued, "Ascetic Shibi, why aren't you traveling to study?" Gensha replied, "Bodhidharma did not come to China. The second patriarch did not go to India." This gained Seppo's special praise. So he said, "I will never deceive others." What is this ascetic Shibi? "I will never deceive others." How would he deceive others? Somebody asks you, "Who are you?" What are you going to say? Whatever you would say is deception. Do you believe it yourself, what you just said? Of course, in a practical way, we can answer that question. We can give them our name. We can let them know a little bit about ourselves or whatever. But if we are awake, we realize that really nothing has been exchanged here. Nothing has been told. Nothing's been revealed or understood. What are you? Who are you? To say anything at all. So you give the person your name. What does that mean? What is this? So next time, they can call you. And if you're in the room, maybe you'll turn your head. You know, it's all very practical stuff, very useful. But what reality, when they say, "What are you? Who are you?" What can you possibly say? What is this ascetic Shibi? He says, "I will never deceive others." This answer greatly pleased Seppo. He said, "I will never deceive others." Because he's not going to participate in this deception. And particularly to a Zen master like Seppo. Seppo knows. And Seppo is testing him, wants to see what Genshin knows. So I will never deceive others. But then he went a little further. He said, there's no one who does not harbor those words. Well, who wouldn't think like this? Who wants to deceive others? We may all have this feeling, I don't want to deceive others. Of course, there might be those occasions where maybe you do want to deceive others. But if you really understood your situation, you wouldn't want to deceive others, because the pain of that comes back to you. You're not really putting anything over on someone else. You're putting something over on yourself. So who wouldn't speak in this way? There's no one who does not harbor those words. That can be taken in another way too, but that'll come out in the next line here. But he said, yet no one can utter them. So there's no one who does not harbor those words, and yet at the same time, no one can utter them. No one can actually say this. Because even in saying, I don't want to deceive others, meaning that I don't want to participate in this deception, saying that I am such and such or whatever, and yet there's nothing here. The body is non-existent, as he said earlier. There's nothing. There's no particular thing here to even name or to try to set out there for one another. So he says no one could utter those words. Because even in saying, I don't want to deceive others, well, just kind of recapping just what he said. Yeah, there's no one who can utter that. We might all feel this way, looking at it in this very ordinary way, but we can't actually pull the deception off, because no one is actually doing this. No one is actually getting away with anything. Nothing here is being defined. No one can actually utter these words. These words that, to the extent that they are pointing to the truth, to reality, no one is actually uttering those words. To the extent that we are formed as an ego and then we try to speak the truth, it is coming out like ordinary language. If it is coming from some particular place, then it is speaking of some particular entity out there, some particular situation, some particularness out there. And this is deception. So these words, in speaking in the way that Genshin did, no one is actually uttering this. Seppo already saw this in Genshin, that Genshin realized this. So then he continued, he said, ascetic Shibi, why aren't you traveling to study? Just checking this a little further, why aren't you traveling to study? And Genshin replied, Bodhidharma did not come to China. The second patriarch did not go to India. And this gained Seppo's special praise. Yeah, well, this line, Bodhidharma did not, we all know about Bodhidharma, huh? Bodhidharma was maybe 400 years or so before the time that these fellows were having this exchange. Bodhidharma is about as far from them as, say, the pilgrims are from us, the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock there. That's roughly 400 years ago now. So about that much time has elapsed here. And he's speaking of Bodhidharma. Well, Bodhidharma was the Brahmin who came from India into China, brought Zen into China. And then, of course, he transmitted to the second patriarch there. And yet, this is the story. Bodhidharma comes to China. He meets up with the second patriarch, and the Dharma transmission takes place. And because of this event, here we have Seppo and now Genshin coming along 400 years later. But Genshin here says that Bodhidharma did not come from China. The second patriarch did not go to India. What does this mean? Well, it's just that reality is reality. It's neither here nor there. It isn't something that can be transported or transmitted. It isn't anything like this. And there's no particular one here who has it or who then transmits it to another particular person over here. Reality is just thus. This is just this right here. That we're inseparable from it. That at any moment, any one of us can awaken to it. And it isn't a matter of that Bodhidharma brought something from India to China, nor is it a matter that the second patriarch went from China to India to pick it up. These things didn't occur as such. That the reality is just, you know, simply right here. It is all taking place within this space. It's only in our world of thinking, in our world of delusion, where everything is divided up and spread out in time and space. and where one thing gets exchanged with another. This matter of suddenly awakening to the transiency of the world, realizing the emptiness of the body and of the mind, and that there's nothing holding still for one moment. This is reality itself. Something that can be realized directly, and in fact actually is realized by all of us. It's just that most of us are not paying attention. So why aren't you going to study? Why aren't you going to travel? Why aren't you going to visit with these other teachers? And he said, Bodhidharma didn't, you know, so who... Once we awaken to this reality that is right here, we don't need to go after and chase about. Before that, we might think that maybe we do. And it's not that you can't or that you shouldn't or that you won't, but it is really not necessary, because when you awaken, you will awaken here. And it doesn't matter where you have gone or where you have been. Of course, very necessary, not just helpful, but very necessary for us to encounter a teacher to point out some of these things for us. But Genshe has already met Seppo, and already through Seppo, he has this understanding. It is not necessary for him now to go about and to chase about, to find another teacher. What is he going to learn? He already has had full awakening right here. So reality is omnipresent. We can wake up to it anywhere, and Genshe already has. What's the point of going off here and there? So this gained Seppo's special praise. But because he had up to then been a fisherman, he had never seen the various scriptures, talking about Genshe again here, he had never seen the various scriptures and treatises, even in his dreams. Yet nevertheless, because the depth of his aspirations was paramount, a determined spirit beyond others had appeared. Seppo thought him outstanding in the community and praised him as being a standard among his disciples. So because he had been up to then, he'd just been a fisherman, he had never seen the various teachings, the various scriptures and treatises, not even in his dreams, it says here. You know, so that's one thing there. We can go off and study. We can, you know, and it's good to familiarize ourselves with this. But this critical point here that is so easy for us to overlook, that he said, yet because the depth of his aspirations was paramount, the depth of his aspirations was of supreme importance. And because of this, he had right intention. He was determined to get to the bottom of this matter, awakening to the transiency of the world. And because of that, a determined spirit beyond others had appeared. And this is absolutely crucial, that if we don't have this determination within ourselves to awaken, I mean, you can study all you want, you can sit on the cushion all you want, you can be striving for something in particular all you want, you can be imagining how nice it would be if we would just, if I would just wake up. As long as you're reaching and grasping in that ordinary way, this is not a true aspiration. The desire should just simply be to realize this right here, that we engage this moment completely, thoroughly, the practice, the teaching, and for no reason. If you can only practice, and if your practice remains limited to bringing yourself to the cushion because you think through this you're going to get somewhere, you're not realizing what you're doing as you sit on the cushion. You do not realize what you're doing as you look at these teachings. You don't realize what you're doing when you're eating oryoki, or when you're sitting at your kitchen table at home and eating with your fork. We must have this desire, this aspiration to awaken, and to awaken in each moment. This is absolutely paramount. This is of supreme importance, because without this, and this is right intention, without this, we do not awaken. We have to realize that awakening is going to be will occur in this moment, and it comes of its own. It's like the fish that swims into the net without fishing for it. It comes of its own, but we have to be there. We have to be present with it. This is the supreme aspiration. The depth of his aspiration was just this: to practice this thoroughly, diligently, fully, completely, and without reason, without trying to get something from it. this will awaken a determined spirit within you that surpasses everyone. And he says, right, a determined spirit beyond others had appeared. And with this kind of a determined spirit, you will wake up. I used to say 2 years. You might say, well, yes, but I want to do that. But it has to be pure. It has to be not for some reason. Not because, and what are we talking about? We are talking about nothing more than being in this moment. Just coming into this moment, just to really be here. To feel the pain in your knee, or whatever it is, to hear the robin, the jet plane. To just be present in this moment completely, thoroughly. To realize what this is. That the body is non-existent, that it is transient, changing, that this is all changing, that this is the life and the reality of this moment. To have a determination to get to this and to see this purely, completely for itself. Without this desire to really see what this is, to always peel it off in some way to some storyline, to some explanation of what you're doing and why you're doing it, this leaves us entangled, caught up in thinking and in trying to get, trying to appease. And nothing happens. Well, I shouldn't say nothing happens. Things are always happening. But that's to continue in our confusion and in our delusion. We have to have this aspiration to awaken. And it has to be a paramount, meaning of supreme importance, that it is just to awaken and for nothing else. This is crucial. And we have to understand that. Maybe we find it hard to think that we could do something for no reason. But at some point we can learn to do that, just realize, because in effect, you're doing things anyway. And even though you might apply reasons and a storyline to whatever it is you're doing, if you look very carefully, you realize that your reasons don't add up, they don't make sense. They don't really satisfy you. They don't really explain anything. The storyline doesn't explain anything. And yet this is really taking place, even though this isn't anything in particular. So this is a very important point. It's a subtle point. I don't know if I'm making it clear or not. But it is something we really have to understand about our practice. And to just learn to settle down. Because to the extent that we settle into this practice, and yet we're still thinking about something else, that this will lead to something. What is that? That doesn't exist. That is just thinking. That is imagination. This is your practice here. And all we're talking about is to learn to be here without doing that. Without reaching for that. Without having anything to say about it. Nothing to say. I won't deceive others. I won't say anything about this. Can't say anything about it. Somehow we have to have a mind like that, an aspiration like that. That the depth of your aspiration becoming paramount, becoming of supreme importance. Nothing equal to that. And with that, awakening is assured. And I'm not joking, but we have to get very clear on what that state of mind is, to just be here completely. It doesn't mean to force yourself into something. Just in a very gentle way, just be here. Just be here. And what? For no reason, for without some other storyline taking place. And with that, we do awaken, just as Genshe did. So the depth of his aspiration was paramount. With the determined spirit had appeared, and Seppo thought him outstanding. Yeah, this determined spirit then, that mind that I'm trying to point to here, if that appears, you will engage this practice in a very easy way, and yet you will do it. And I mean do it smoothly and completely and thoroughly and totally, easily. Even though other kinds of things might wobble in your mind or whatever, and yet you'll be able just to sidestep that and maintain a steady practice. Our usual way is where we're trying to fix the mind, you know, where we're very erratic and wobbly, you know, in our practice. Not just our practice, but our practice is our life. whatever our practice is, whatever our life is, that's our practice. That's what we're doing. We can either do it deliberately, consciously, and bring it to this, or not. And to the extent that we learn to do this, then awakening is sure to follow. Within 2 years, it will follow. Never mind that 2 year point. Well, don't never mind the 2 year point. Yeah, find that. Realize what that state of mind is. And never mind the 2 year duration after that. That's just something I say. So Sepal thought him outstanding in the community. I'm sure he was, because very few people get to this point where they understand this practice in that way. But it can easily be done. It's just that we have to really get clear on it, get clear in our own mind just what it is that we're doing here. But Sepal thought him outstanding in the community, and he praised him as being the standard among his disciples. Look at Gensha. Yeah. But if you look at Gensha, just don't look at Gensha, but realize if you run into someone like Gensha, just realize that what does Gensha know? What is Gensha doing? What does Gensha understand here? Let's consider that for a moment. That it isn't that Gensha is doing something magically, you know, or that he was somehow touched. What is it that the meatball hit him? Or you remember that story of the meatball? No. Gensha has come to some realization here. He gives a little description here of Gensha. Then he said he dressed in plain muslin, and because he never replaced his one robe, it was all patched. Yeah, so he just went around with just patches, patches sewn to patches. He used paper for his underclothing, and he also wore mugwort plants. This was not a snappy dresser. So, and this mugwort plant, this is kind of a fibrous plant that they would beat. They would beat it and then dry it, so you get all these fibers, and then they'd weave this, pound it down, and weave it into a kind of a very, you know, crude kind of cloth that you'd wear under your clothing, you know, to keep you warm. So he wore mugwort plants, you know. So he's very, very plain. He wasn't really hung up. Not that we all have to go around wearing mugwort or anything like this, but but he wasn't caught up in such things. Because he had this determination, this aspiration to get to the truth. That was his focus. It wasn't on what he was wearing, any of the other kind of stuff. You know, of course we have to take care of the body and keep ourselves sheltered and warm and fed and clothed and all of that. But there's a limit. And we all live in a very affluent society here. It's pretty easy for us to take care of those needs. But of course, living in this affluent society, and we look all around us, and you know, and people are, you know, living, you know, they have their three-car garage and on and on and on. And then we might feel that we have to do this. But you don't have to do that. I remember as a young man studying Thoreau. I really got into Thoreau when I was in high school, and I don't know if this was the influence or not, but, you know, looking at Thoreau, you realize, what's important in life, and how much time do you want to spend? How much time do you want to spend getting stuff, and why? You know, but I think most of us, we don't really look at that. We think somehow we're comfortable with that, but, well, maybe you are comfortable with a lot of stuff. But if you look carefully, you're really not. You're only kind of superficially comfortable and outwardly comfortable. Because, okay, you've always got a soft couch to sit on, and you got this and that and whatever. But your mind is acquisitive. Your mind is grasping and dissatisfied. It's worrying about what the neighbors are thinking, and you got to keep up with this and on and on. And how much of your time and energy do you want to spend with that? Isn't there something more that's of supreme importance that we're ignoring here? I think if we get a sense of that, like, you know, Thoreau spoke of that, like he wasn't going to spend all this time getting a lot of stuff, that there are other things to attend to, and things out of which, if we turn our attention in these ways, we can find far greater satisfaction to the extent that no comparison, as it would say in the Diamond Sutra, is even possible. So it's fairly easy to get enough. But what's difficult is to realize when that has occurred. And now you can turn your attention to this great aspiration that if we do really want to wake up, we should realize how this fits into other aspects of our life as well. But again, I mean, we don't have to go around in muslin and mugwort. But still, at the same time, we should consider these things a little bit. He didn't call on any other teacher except Seppo. He was going to go off to see these other teachers, and yet he had this incident with the toe. He woke up, and Seppo was enough. And he became one of the great Zen masters. He didn't call on any teacher except Seppo. Nevertheless, he had attained the ability to inherit his teacher's way. And he inherited the ability. Well, this all came through his determination to wake up and to see just what that is, what this is. And this is, as I said so many times already now, but this is of supreme importance and yet so easily overlooked. But that's the end of the first part there where he meets up with Seppo. Now we get into this section where he has an encounter with his teacher. And this is what Dogen then picks up and expounds in the second part, which we'll get to probably tomorrow. He said, after he finally attained the way, he would say in order to instruct people, all the universe is one bright pearl. So all the universe, yeah, this all the universe, this is reality as a whole, totality. It is all one bright pearl, he says. Literally, I think what the term was being used here was the 10 directions. In China, you know, they have, after going through everything, they became fascinated with the number 10. Everything had to be in 10, so they had 10s, you know, so they had the 10 directions. When 6 are adequate, you know, there's, or even 3, I mean, there's 3 dimensions, you know, and then you can go either direction on in either, you know, in any of the 3. So, you know, 6 would have been enough. But the Chinese, you know, they really wanted 10. So, I mean, because you can go east, west, north, south, and zenith and nadir, right? So, I mean, that would have handled it. But then they also put in southwest and northeast. And well, anyway, but that's a term that's actually being used here. I used to always puzzle about that. But well, anyway, but what he's saying here is that all the universe, or the 10 directions, is one bright pearl. But what he's speaking of is totality and reality as a whole. It is one bright pearl. This was Genshe's teaching. This is what he would offer people. All the universe is one bright pearl. And it's easy, you know, when a teacher will, they'll have some understanding here and then they'll say that. They'll make some phrase like that. All the universe is one bright pearl. Sometimes a teacher will get known for a particular saying like that, as Genshe was here. All the universe is one bright pearl. Well, look what happens here, though. Genshe, of course, this came out of Genshe with a depth of understanding. But look what happens here. Once a monk asked him, he says, I hear you have said that all the universe is one bright pearl. How can I gain understanding of this? So, you see, Genshe, through this determination of mind that I was speaking of, trying to make clear, having that determination of mind. But it was out of that determination of mind that he not only inherited Seppo's teaching, but this whole statement, all the universe is one bright pearl, is coming out of that. It's coming out of a deep understanding of the nature of reality and what is taking place here. So he says, all the universe is one bright pearl. And for us, we could hear that all the universe is one bright pearl. And realize that for ourselves, that all the universe is one bright pearl. But the monk hears Genshe say this, and he says, I hear you say this. Now, how can I get hold of that? How can I? It isn't like to stop looking out there at something that you just said, as we're so prone to do. That's what we used to. The teacher says something, and you look out there like it's out there. Like, stop. And realize what's taking place right here with you now. This is what the teacher's talking about. Not talking about something out there for you to grasp, take hold of, get some idea of it. That's not good enough. Were you to awaken to this, whatever it was that made Genshe say that, That's right here. You can find it too. You don't have to say the same thing. No, necessarily. In fact, it'd be rather foolish of you to do so. And you wouldn't, were this just to originate with you. Nevertheless, we should listen carefully and look carefully at what Genpo says, or what an enlightened teacher like this says. But to think that, how can I gain understanding of that? How can I get the idea of this, basically, is what he was saying. So he says, I hear you say that all the universe is one by pearl. How can I gain understanding of this? The master said, that would be Genpo. He said, all the universe is one bright pearl. What need is there to understand it? What need is there for you to get some idea of this? All the universe is one bright pearl. There's no need for you to grasp this, to take hold of it in some way, to get some idea of it, is what Genpo is saying there. Well, the next day, the master himself asked the monk. So here now we have Genpo coming back, and the Genpo asked the monk, all the universe is one bright pearl. What is your understanding of it? So, I mean, the day before he says, how can I gain understanding of this? And then he says, all the universe is one bright pearl. What need is there to understand it? Day later, Genpo sees the monk and he says, all the universe is one bright pearl. What is your understanding of it? Well, because he took the monk and threw away, you want to get some idea of it, threw that away. Now, what? It's like the job is over now? Now you're off the hook? Not to, you know, forget it? Genpo was giving the monk teaching. What was the monk doing? Did the monk contemplate? Did he look at this? Did he try to find it right here? Well, we'll see. Genpo was testing him. He said, the next day, the master asked him, all the universe is one bright pearl. What is your understanding of it? The monk answered, all the universe is one bright pearl. What need is there to understand it? He just regurgitated what Genpo said the day before. And Genpo says, I know now, replied Genpo, that you are living in a ghost cave in the mountain of darkness. Yeah, in this ghost cave in the mountain of darkness, there's this, in the mythology there, there's this this cave, this mountain of darkness. It's called the mountain of darkness because it is so far away from anything that it doesn't receive any light. I mean, it is so far away. I mean, there's no sunlight, no moonlight, no starlight, nothing. I mean, this is so remote. It is remote beyond remote. There is this mountain, the mountain of darkness. No light. Now, have you ever been in a place where there's no light? I remember once going into, well, these different caves and things, Mammoth Cave and that, and I remember being in some room where they turn off the lights. You know, they tell you to put your hand in front of you. You can't see anything. I mean, it's just total darkness, right? So here, this is the image now where we got this. But here we're on a mountain in total darkness. And then, that ain't enough, you see. I love this imagery. There's a cave there, you know, on this mountain. So you go into this cave on this mountain in total darkness, and it's not just an ordinary cave. It's a ghost cave on top of it. So you're, I mean, this is really, really being in darkness. So he says, I know now that you are living in a ghost cave in the mountain of darkness. So when the monk responded, just regurgitated what Genpo said, so what's he talking about here? Well, this ghost cave is referring to the fact that it's really talking about sentient beings. That we cling to forms and ideas, things that we can grasp. This is where we're always searching and reaching in this way. Clinging to sensations and concepts and ideas. And in particular, this matter of this ghost cave is referring to one who would cling to emptiness. Or this teaching of wholeness and totality, we cling to it as though it were something, but not just that, but as though it were something that signified nothing. In other words, it's kind of equating emptiness with nihilism or nothingness. But it's not a real understanding even of that, but of holding that as an idea. So in other words, this monk in just regurgitating what Genshaw had said, you know, what is your understanding of this? And he says, well, the universe is one bright pearl. What need is there to understand it? But he had just, it was so cheap. Genshaw's understanding comes out of this really deep understanding, this deep awakening to reality itself. And he speaks, all the universe is one bright pearl. He told the monk, too, what need is there to understand this? What need is there to grasp? You can't grasp this. And what need is there for that anyway? You're just going to get hold of some idea. But nevertheless, there is understanding. Nevertheless, we can wake up to reality and we can see this. We can even wake up and understand what it is that Genshaw is saying. So the next day, Genshaw asked him, well, what is your understanding of this? All the universe is one bright pearl. The monk. Well, you got to give him credit. He had the nerve to just sit there and spit back what Genshaw had said. But so foolish that what Genshaw then is referring to this is just, this ghost cave, this ascension beings, those who are not awake, reach for something that they can grasp and take hold of it in this way, just holding to an idea. Holding to an idea of enlightenment, holding to an idea of emptiness. Remember what Nagarjuna said about those who hold to an idea of emptiness? He said they're incorrigible. You know, that there's no hope for these guys, these people. You know, you hold to this notion of emptiness. Worse yet, thinking or equating it with nothingness. But this is what this monk was doing here, just, you know, reaching, as if maybe... What? We're playing a game here. That he could come back. The monk, to respond in that way so flippantly, didn't have even a sense of the depth and the experience and the realization that Genshaw had. It isn't like that monk when Huineng, you know, asked him, where are you from? And he said, well, I'm from Tangshan. And then he said, what is it that does come? And that monk became speechless for 8 years. Wow, this monk treated it in a very cheap way. And so Genshaw replied in this way. And I remember earlier where we had gone to this before, somebody said, well, that's very unkind, you know. No, this response of Genshaw's was out of deep compassion. We'll look into that tomorrow. It was out of very deep compassion that Genshaw spoke to him in this way. If for nothing else than just to jolt him into realizing that this is life and death, this is serious business. We shouldn't treat it so lightly and flippantly and just toss this. Even to speak of the ghost cave, as Dogen will say when we get to the end of this, this is all reality. This is all the truth. It is all right here. And that which will free us from suffering and confusion and pain, misery, not understanding, that is all right here too, if we treat this properly and we don't treat this in some kind of flippant manner. We don't have to become morose and somber, and it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean we have to practice in this way. We can practice with a cheerful heart. We can also be maybe a serious face or two. It doesn't really matter what kind of face we put on. But I mean that. It doesn't matter. So in other words, we can't even be, bright and cheerful. But our heart has to be, we have to be serious about this. We have to mean this practice when we take it up and do it. That we can't just take it lightly. Because if we don't take it up, if it doesn't become paramount, if our determination to get to the truth of this matter isn't paramount, then we won't find it. And yet, as we're going to see, it's right at hand. It is just right here. It is so easy. It is no more than just the turning over of a leaf. And we have it. But without this determination of mind, we don't realize that. And we'll struggle with the practice. We'll do all sorts of things. And treat the teaching. And we have all these Zen jokes. And of course, they're fine. And some of them are actually funny. And I'll laugh at them too. But we also have to be kind of careful with these teachings. We'll flip them around because we hear them so much, perhaps, that they just become like jokes. But we should be careful of that. And also be careful of what you're flipping around, what you're tossing around, because if you don't understand it, you're just like this monk in the ghost cave on the mountain of darkness. So we have to be very careful with this teaching. But most of all, we have to find this determination of mind, this aspiration of mind. It's pure to really get to the truth. We can have that even while we are living our life in the world, interacting with others, even with a cheerful disposition, but we can still have that, that desire that's paramount to get to the bottom of this matter, to wake up. Well, we're up to part two here, so Dogen, in the next part now, he takes up this exchange between Genshin and the monk, and he'll expound on that, and we'll look into that tomorrow. But do you have any questions? Yes.
I have some questions that come up when I'm meditating. I think they're sort of related to Genshin's question of where the pain comes from after he steps his soul. I wonder where my class came from, or why some class come instead of others. And I wonder where the sounds come from here. And I wonder if the class and the sounds have different levels of reality, or if that's even an appropriate question.
No, it's a very good question. I wouldn't say there are different levels of reality necessarily, but you're talking about thoughts and sounds, and yeah. But you know the story of, I've used this a number of times, but you know the story of the two monks arguing about the flag in the breeze? Yeah, so one thinks it's a flag. You know, once again, right, there's something we can grasp, something we can get hold of. The other says the breeze. Little less easily gotten hold of, you know, the breeze. Nevertheless, we can still grasp that as an idea. But Hui Neng, he came along and he said, no, not flag, not breeze, mind. Mind is moving. They're arguing about what's moving, right? The flag is moving, the wind is moving. Hui Neng says, mind is moving. So this mind is moving, mind is energy, mind is change, mind is moving. That's what mind is. Mind is moving. Mind is movement. Mind is change. This is the functioning of mind. And so with the functioning of mind, there is sound and there is thought. But this thought and this sound that is mind is also no thought and no sound. And so no sound is also sound. We don't think that way. We think there's sound, and then there's this other thing where it's called no sound. Then we give it another word. We call it silence. But silence is also sound. And sound is silence, you know. So when we ask where something is coming from, where it is going, well, when we see it now in totality, in this whole picture, nothing's coming from anywhere. Nothing's going. We'll actually get into this a bit tomorrow. But nothing's coming from anywhere. And nothing's actually going anywhere. And yet there is the appearance here. So it's kind of like there's no body, and yet there's this body. So like you said, the body is non-existent, meaning the body doesn't persist. There's nothing here from moment to moment to moment that's a body. And yet there's a body here. There's also pain here. It's pain in this body, in this toe. There's this pain. But if we look at it in totality, nothing is actually, you know, coming into the picture. Nothing is actually leaving. We say in Zen, nothing actually enters or leaves the mind. Of course, we're confused by that because it seems like there's all kinds of things that enter and leave my mind. Yeah, but of course your mind, my mind, is an isolated thing, a cut-off thing, separate from other minds. Which is a problem in Western philosophy, not in Buddhist philosophy. There aren't other minds. Because this thing that we call my mind and your mind aren't actually mind. Strictly speaking, there isn't any such thing as I as my mind or your mind. Because we can't find what does I refer to? Whose mind? You see. Nevertheless, this mind will show up just like the pain and the toe and the body, they show up. And yet we try to get hold of any one of these things and we can't find anything there. But does that mean that there's nothing going on? No, obviously there's things going on. A toe is showing up, and thought and pain and my mind and your mind, and they all show up. But they're showing up in this realm of totality. They're not showing up as themselves, as something enduring or persisting. they show up in this realm of totality, which is what is real, and that is mind. So it is mind moving, mind functioning, mind changing. That is where all of this stuff comes from. The problem that we suffer from is that we take these things to be substantial and things unto themselves, and we cling to that. And there's where our suffering comes from, in our confusion. You know, the suffering is all the confusion, because we don't actually understand what is taking place here. Did that help you there, John? Or, yeah. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
When you speak about determination, mm-hmm. it makes me reflect and ask, you know, do I have it?
Yeah.
And then I have a lot of advantages trying to understand what that determination would be like.
Mm. Yeah. Well, forget about determination and forget about what it would be like, and just focus on, realize the deep need that we have really to awaken. This is what we want. That's that golden fish. But we don't know what it is. So for us to try to put something there, to think of what that would be, or even what the determination to find it is, that's really too much. Just realize that what we are talking about, that determination, is to be here, to be present, to bring ourselves into this moment and to simply to see it. Maybe out of a curiosity, I want to know. Maybe that's even too much. But just to be here. I want to know what this is. It's not, forget enlightenment or determination, but this desire to just understand this. To be here, to be present with reality, to wake up to our inseparability from it. Let that be your focus. Realize that it isn't a particular thing, because in each moment something fresh, new is occurring. But it is just really this matter to do this. It's very difficult for us to do that, because we're thinking, now why would I do that? Because then I'll get this other prize over here. But what we have to realize is that this is fantasy. This is make-believe. This is just thought. Whatever it is that we think we're going to get, it's off in the future, it's somewhere else. It's not, but it's not even real. It's just mental construction. And we suffer for that. We long for it. We reach for it. We're driven by it. We're afraid of one thing or another. That might entangle us and not allow... All the while, here we are. We can come back to just seeing this. It is in learning to just be here. You see, what I'm saying is so simple that you're probably not quite hearing what I'm saying. It is so simple. And that, what is that determination? That determination is just to be here. To bring yourself back to this. This is the effort. This is the right, your intention. That determination is the intention to just be here. To catch yourself when you realize, well, you're doing this for some other reason. For something else, which is fantasy once again. Start to recognize that that's fantasy. You're thinking, you're wondering, you're daydreaming, and all the while, you're not here. It is so simple that we miss it, because it is just a matter of just come back to this and come back to this. And at some point, if we really learn to do this, at some point what happens is our ability to distract ourselves weakens, and our ability to... what can I say? To make excuses for not coming back to this becomes so weak that it doesn't interfere anymore. And then we can learn to be here. And then we can wake up to just what that is. So don't think about enlightenment, or don't think about a determination. Just bring yourself back to this moment, and maybe, if anything, notice how it is that you'll keep reaching to bring yourself away. Notice that. Notice the delusion, I guess, maybe, then, rather than to speculate on the enlightenment or the kind of mind that practices with this kind of determination. Another way of looking at it, that the enlightenment is nothing more than finally realizing the delusion. And once we're pretty clear on that, then we can start to work on not stepping in it all the time. But that's something else again. In the meantime, first thing we need to do is to realize how it is that we deceive ourselves, that we take ourselves away. And for no reason. Never getting what it is that we want. Never. We even kind of know this, and yet we still think, well, maybe if I just do it this other way this time. You know. And that's all just thinking, spinning away. And it's not being here. It's caught up in thinking and fantasy, imagining. In the meantime, we're here. We're here. Bring yourself back to here. You wander away again, just come back. That's actually what our practice is. There's nothing more than that. In a sesshin like now, we minimize our activity, so there's very few things out there for us, you know, to pull us away. But of course, the mind is wonderful at manufacturing stuff to distract us, to take us away. But a longer sesshin gives us a chance to let this settle down a bit, because maybe after 3 days, you know, there's less that's going to be pulling you away. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe it takes 5 days. But there is this, I don't know if I want to call it a skill, but we can learn this. We can learn just to, learn what? Learn to recognize when we're not here. Learn to recognize when we're just reaching. And especially learn to recognize when we're off in some fantasy idea about enlightenment or what the practicing mind is or something like that. That's just projection. That's just catapulting ourselves out of reality and into, of course, as we'll see, it's still, he'll talk about this, still one bright pearl, even though it's our delusion. But we don't have to practice delusion. We have to practice enlightenment, and you are, but we don't pay attention to it. But we don't have to practice delusion. I don't know, did that help you, Myung Hee? Okay. Yes, Mary.
So when we come into this moment, when we really come into this moment, we're in this moment, we learn to be here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what building means when he says from the first dullness and distractions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, from the first, it's kind of like saying, because we'll get into this tomorrow too, that from the first, this is why it's such a beautiful piece. I mean, there's a lot in that, you're going to see in that phrase, one bright pearl. But from the first means that this isn't taking place in time. So if we're in this moment, everything's included now. Everything. Quite literally, everything. I mean, the past, everything is in this moment. And if we're in this moment, we'll see that. We'll wake up to that. So from the first, dullness, everything, it's all struck aside. So it's like any kind of sense you might have about, oh, the years I wasted before I realized, with awakening, that's all gone. That doesn't exist. So don't. If you have any kind of anxiety about your progress on the path, you know, oh, I started this too late in life, or I'm getting old now, or geez, if I only learned this, or, you know, all of that belongs to the realm of delusion. With awakening, that all disappears. It disappears. It doesn't. You know, it doesn't have any reality in the first place. So all I'm saying now is, just don't be discouraged. Same thing too about all this talk about how all the millions of kalpas it's going to take you to achieve enlightenment. If you practice hard for millions of kalpas. That can be discouraging too. But with the moment we wake up to what it is that we're doing with this practice, and not just in the formal way here where we minimize everything, you know, but we can do this at any time. But the moment we wake up to that, all of that has, it just turns into mist, smoke, whatever. Not even that. It's just, there is no such thing. It goes the way of the boogeyman once we say, ooh, well, there's no boogeyman. Yeah, there you go. Or the deep, dark, mysterious questions about what lies beyond the ends of the earth. You know, it's just wrong picture. With awakening, suddenly, that's gone. Including your years of struggle and the time frame in which you entered on this path and all that stuff. It's gone. All of that is fabrication, mental construction. None of it is real. And it has a certain kind of reality, but it's not ultimately real. So don't ever get discouraged. You know, no matter where you are, because you right now you can pick it up. You can pick up reality right now. I mean, that's not a very good way of putting it, but right now you can allow reality to pick you up. Of course, reality already has. It's just a matter of seeing that. But that can occur. You know, and what are we talking about? That's why this determination is so important. This determination of mind to just be here is so important. It is of paramount. It's of supreme importance. Now, this is a point that I hope I can get that across to you. Because without that, this doesn't occur. With it, this is inevitable. So when you get clear on just what that is, and that again, it's not get clear in the sense of trying to figure out what that determination of mine is, but all we're talking about is the determination to get serious about this, seeing what this moment is, just being here, present with it. This is what we need to do, without having some ulterior notion or ideas about what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it. I mean, those thoughts and ideas can be there, that's fine, but you don't, you can have all kinds of thoughts that you don't actually have to embrace or hold, you know, or believe in, or trust. You know, thoughts can come up in your mind all the time. But it's the stuff that you actually embrace, you take hold of that thought. Oh, this is how you're seeing, you think, oh, it's like this, and you're holding to something. If you're holding to a formed thing like that, just realize it's delusion. The determination of mind is to bring yourself back to noticing that. Noticing that you're doing that. And you're doing it again. And you're doing it. And you start to recognize that. Then we can wake up. And with that awakening, all of the past, all of this, you know, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything at all. But before that, we can be so troubled by it. I've wasted my life, or I've done this, or I've done that. No.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.